Hello again, everybody.
We don't have a break.
We are wondering now where we find ourselves. We have shifted our question. And I think I'm going to start by posing a question for Luciana. You're intercepting us in the midst of a conversation that we started over lunch yesterday to kind of get a sense of where our conversation might go. So I'll ask you to bear with me just for a moment while you intercept us in mid-phrase, so to speak. Luciana, yesterday one of the phrases that came out in our conversation that intrigues me absolutely is the phrase planetary computation, and so we were talking about the technosphere in the most general sense about what planetary computation might be thought of, and one of the issues that came up was the sense of epical shifts in the technosphere, and in particular a shift in the middle of the 20th century. That shift seemed to be summed up by the notion that that tools came to be means of concretizing logic. I love this. Hello. tool as a means of concretizing logic, of making concrete logic. But then I thought, now I'm going to look back to my long durée. I look back across human evolution in my work, and I thought about a couple of contrasting technologies from the Paleolithic era. One of them that goes back 1.75 million years. Now, the human species goes back maybe 300,000 years. We have to remember always that the technosphere was here a long time before our species was here, that we have always been made in the guise of a technosphere of one sort or another. But given that, so there's this very ancient technology. It's a very simple one. It's called the Acheulean industry, as archaeologists call it. And you take a core and you chip away at this core, and eventually you make a symmetrical biface with an edge around it of some sort. These things are dug up by the thousands. Hugely widely dispersed, a long-lasting industry. Over 1.5 million years, it was the only prominent industry, and performed by many species, by the way, of hominins. Think of that, an industry that is made by many different species. That's interesting in and of itself. But what there isn't in the making of an Acheulean biface, what you do is you chip away, and with each chip you sort of say, well, I guess I need to chip here next. I guess I need to chip here next. There's not any very strong sense of an organization, of a logic that might be concretized in the technology. Move ahead, fast forward now to 350,000 years ago or so, when the Levallois technology emerged, very much studied in Neanderthals and also in our ancestors in Africa. This technology now requires you to take a core and do certain operations, first of all to choose your core carefully, then to do certain operations on that core so as to prepare for certain different operations on that core, so as to prepare for a third array of different operations, at which point, if you've done it all right — it's damned hard, by the way, but if you've done it all right, you can, with one strike of the hammer stone, lop off a perfectly formed point, something to haft onto the end of a stick to make an arrow or a spear out of. That seems to me to be concretized logic in a machine. And so I wondered aloud yesterday to Luciana, I don't want to deny a huge difference in the middle of the 20th century, but I'm wondering how it is that we can specify more clearly what that difference is, what the new mode of concretizing logic is that brings about finally planetary computation.
Yes, no, thanks for this question. I guess I was thinking about two things. One, the only reason why we can interpret what you said is because of an epistemological lens, okay? So that we are scientifically able and philosophically able to understand what is about this ancient mode of calculation that creates some kind of cosmotechnics and a cognitive understanding of the world concretized in this chipping of the stone. So, in a way, it wasn't like that when it happened. So we have some kind of retroactive capacity to look back, which is to do with modernity. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we first. Then I think, second of all, I am interested in this shift from when the articulation of tool in the Aristotelian tradition was defined in terms of cause linked to an action, or was defined by the fact that we can understand the cause of a tool, i.e. in the use or usability or cross-usability, but nonetheless the cause remains quite clearly articulating into an external force moving another force, okay, or an object, okay? So, and this, although I don't agree completely, but what I agree with when Heidegger comes up with the question of technology, with the modern question of technology, says in a very kind of worrying way, he says, actually, we don't understand the cause of this technology anymore. Something happens in the cybernetic system, or the articulation of a cybernetic system in terms of feedback, but more importantly for me, in terms of automation. There's something whereby the tool is no longer activated by an external force. We can't think of it in terms of physics, but we need to think of it in terms of some kind of self-learning mechanism. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, the question, that's where the question opens up a lot of possibility of how we understand tools retroactively. So one could argue, yeah, actually there is a level of computation in what you're talking about. There is a logic, you know, the point is not to deny that a logic was there to start with, but that what became in the of that logic, to open logic to a capacity to revise, you know, to open the horizon of what can be thought, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens then with cybernetics, we were talking about it yesterday, simultaneously in the 40s and before with Turing in the 1936. So there's an epochal shift where there are two different moments of cybernetic computation that start thinking of automation. So how can we make, how does, you know, the tool actually becomes an automated system that is able to learn and to not just express some kind of function, but reactivate that function over and over again. Which obviously, you know, we know that is not, you know, it's linked or maybe expressed in a more much in a much more intense way, industrial capitalism that had already happened, of course, but in terms of a steam engine. So the difference between a steam engine or the Babbage model that John was talking about becomes quite radical when you actually have a cybernetic system that can self-learn and you have a computational system that can, you know, reduce problems to a set of finite formula. So that's one difference, I would say. And also the question that you don't know the cause, i.e. the cause is embedded and folded within the procedure. And then for me, there is another important question that becomes available to epistemology in modernity, which is when the model of calculation that, you know, we heard before was so dear to Leibniz, was so dear to Babbage. You know, there's this kind of idea of recombining, of taking away thought from God into some kind of possibility of calculative solution. Actually enters stumbles a massive difficulty, which is when it is becomes clear that the formula, the kind of universal mathematical formula, we talked about biology, now you're really shifting to the mathematical, you know, the kind of revenge of mathematical law, when, you know, the universality of the mathematical formula gets interrupted by the idea that actually the universe is incomplete. Thought is incomplete. It's not possible to have one science, i.e. one epistemology that explains how do we know that we know, that actually can complete any kind of answer. So you stumble into the question of incompleteness. The more the quest of the of knowledge, of you know, in, the enterprise, the scientific enterprise into knowing the world, enters the sphere of the unknown, the more it understands that the unknown cannot be contained within the complete formula, the universal mechanism of computation. So that's for me quite
important. That allows me to actually, I love how you just phrased it, because the question of moving the known into the unknown is very much a colonial narrative, right? And so that reminds me that the question that John, I think I said your name wrong. I'm sorry.
My name is not John.
No, you're not.
This is Gary.
Gary, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I'm like, no. Jet lag. The question that Gary is asking ultimately is, what makes our technological revolutions and transformations different from the ones that have happened before? If in fact we can define technology as a multiple, there are different types of technology, different types of technological thinking, perhaps different forms of techno-rationalism that go back into deep time, way back into the past, what makes our particular moment different? And Luciana, your concern is that there has been a certain kind of break in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and so the kinds of technologies and the kinds of technological problems we have are distinct from what we've had. Well, without being able to answer that, I would like to just add some more things to what makes the 20th century and its technological revolutions slightly different from those in the past. Clearly, the birth of cybernetics, if we can date it, certainly I would date it around 1954, Norbert Wiener's Human Use of Human Beings and texts like that. The 1950s is also the period of massive worldwide decolonization. There's a relationship between decolonization and the development of certain kinds of technologies. They certainly happen concurrently. If we don't connect them to each other, at the very least we have to acknowledge that coincidence makes that different from previous technological revolutions. Mm-hmm. In the United States, you also have major challenges to white supremacy, to patriarchy. We have all of these challenges to centrality, and in the context of European and Western philosophy and questions of knowledge and knowledge making, which we critique by connecting it to colonial politics, right? We also have the birth of things like post-structuralism and the critique of the subject and the attempt to reimagine knowledge in non-hierarchical terms. All of these things are coincident. And so that certainly makes for some difference historically between earlier technological revolutions and the one that really prepares us for a word that we're going to get to, I'm sure, at some point, the Anthropocene, right? That's another thing that makes this particular moment different. It's important to also keep in mind that people who were generating things like cybernetics were not immune to racism or not unaware of race. For example, Norbert Wiener spent a lot of time talking about slavery, right? Because he quite accurately understood that if we are on the verge of creating new kinds of beings, new kind of inhuman beings, or beings that will challenge our understanding of what is the human, the only way we had to understand them are beings that we previously had seen as inhuman, which are slaves. And so African slaves become central to how Norbert Wiener imagines cybernetics. So that's just an example of how these technological revolutions are in conversation in lots of ways with broader political concerns. So if in fact there is a difference between our moment and a previous technological moment, it's certainly due to shifts in power, shifts in capitalism, shifts in how the West sees itself globally. And technology becomes very much a part of that narrative.
You know, I know that another phrase that came up yesterday that I want to get back to was a phrase of yours, Lewis, Creole technologies. Mm. But I wonder, I wonder about how we begin to delimit some of those, and I also wonder whether we could talk something phrase that we didn't use yesterday of Creole technospheres, since the technosphere might be subject to the same kind of multiplicity as technologies themselves. There's a pretty big discourse, and I'm now talking way out of my depth, but you know it very well. A pretty big discourse in African American scholarship and Africanist scholarship about these technological multiplicities. And I wonder whether we could talk for a moment about the notion of Creole technospheres or technologies.
I would certainly love to, because in doing so we're talking about multiple epistemologies, multiple modernities, which is a wonderful set of conversations. Yeah. But as we have those conversations about multiplicity, we also have to understand that there is a dominant technosphere that impinges on all the others, right? Which is, in terms of activism and creating a sort of global consensus around environmental transformation, it becomes difficult to incorporate multiple perspectives simply because those multiple perspectives are deeply distrustful of the dominant technosphere, which is the white European one. right? So as we speak about creole technologies and multiple forms of knowledge around technology and multiple types of niche construction, right, we also have to talk about the elephant in the room.
Yeah,
I guess the elephant in the room has definitely to do with, you know, a lineage. You know, there's a lineage of where, you know, technology...
A self-replicating one.
Yes, but there is this fact that when... I mean, you can start thinking about the ship, you know, the slave ship. It's
absolutely
already a technological, almost, you know, computational.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, there were bodies computed, data gathered, masses of population moved, almost like a database.
Yeah.
You know, we can only think about it today because we have that language. Mm-hmm. But the implication...
And genetic transformation.
To think about that... because we have the language of saying, but to think about it retroactively from now also needs to open those kind of epistemologies.
Yeah.
Because what actually happened in terms of automating the servo mechanic, you know, the model of the servo mechanic, on one end you can argue with, for industrial capital that has these roots with colonial encounter, what happened was an industrialization.
Absolutely.
Of mercantilism.
Absolutely.
Right? So, and then what happened instead when what allowed that to bring back to Europe was exactly this kind of transfer of a metaphysics of servo mechanic enslavement into the machine.
And
into the proletariat and into, you know, the affective labor outside that was carrying, you know, was sustaining.
Absolutely.
the proletariat. So there's a lineage that then goes all the way to images of the singularity or transhumanism where the servo mechanic model has worked for so long and is definitely still there working. So there's a
That's been pushed by a number of Caribbean and Black scholars for some time, that to understand modern Western subjectivity is to understand plantation slavery.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to fetishize industrialization in the factory as that which constructs certain kinds of modern subjectivities.
Mm-hmm.
They argue, no, it was the plantation that created modern subjects and rationalized beings, because it was a machine, absolutely.
Yes, but... Sorry.
No, go ahead, please. Yeah. Yes, but
I just wanted to go back to this moment of modernity, as when automation became, or the servo mechanic became automated.
Mm.
Okay, because for me, what happened with computation and with cybernetics at the moment is also this, as I was saying, this encounter with the incomputable, or with this kind of impossibility of kind of compressing all of reality into a formula. And that is also what created a global idea of race. What I mean is that the encounter also acted upon, regressed, or some kind of acted upon virally, you could argue, or you could argue scientifically, in order to transform, you know, the colonial enterprise. So for me, it's very important when we say, where do we find ourselves? We find ourselves at this moment of disjunction where we have all these epistemological elements to redo that history.
Absolutely.
To actually argue that there was a logic of the servo mechanic already in place. It is only because we assume that science and technology are of the power of capital that we can use science and technology to redo it.
To critique it.
Right.
I would just want to add,
go ahead.
Sorry, Gary, just one quick thing. It is absolutely true that what makes our moment unique is in fact the production in the 20th century, but through the 19th century, in the context of colonialism and capitalism, Race, we know, is a product of the 19th century. It's a product of the biological sciences, which is how it sort of re-encodes, right, labor into something more than this labor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is just important to point out that that's another reason why this moment is different. Sorry, Gary.
So no, but if that was very apropos. If I can try just to sum up where we find ourselves in regard to the kinds of things we're talking about here, we are, on the one hand, increasingly aware of the way in which our lives are controlled. We are victimized in various ways by a planetary computation the likes of which we don't begin to understand, right? We don't really begin to understand the mechanism, we don't begin to understand the algorithms and so on. At the same time, as we are struggling, many of us struggling to recognize in the legacy that you were talking about, the need now to elaborate a creolization of technologies and of technospheres across the world. But that creolization, that recognition of the multiplicity is exactly what fragments the resistance that is crucial, the coalition politics, as you put it, that is crucial to mount a resistance to the multinational corporations that are passing off, an algorithmic control of our lives on us. You know, that has just become daunting. So, where we find ourselves is in a very hard place.
Absolutely.
how we balance these: the need to recognize multiplicity with the need to gather together somehow, and into a coalition that can stand any chance against the multinational corporate coalition that
and
is out there.
I really accept and appreciate Luciana's problematizing of crisis, right?
Yeah,
the problematizing of crisis, because or the articulation of constant crisis as the mode of man, that which reiterates man as the center of it. However, it's very difficult to not see actual crisis when it comes to this question of where we are. At the very least, the crisis is where do we find ourselves? For me, it's a crisis of the we. Who's the we? Right? How do we construct new we's, and can we construct new we's in the sake of coalitional politics, given the abuse of identities and we's that impinge on how we understand ourselves?
Can we
create a new we when, in fact, in order for me to communicate with you and you to communicate with me, there are so many encoded histories that work against each other? And that seems to me to be part of the problem of fragmentation, which is also back to the 50s and 60s moment. There is a way in which post-structuralism is a critique of certain kinds of reason, but when it gets picked up by scholars of color in India and Africa and in the Caribbean, it becomes very important to fragmenting the privileges of a white central subject.
Right.
So it becomes a part of what we now sometimes dismissively call identity politics, right? But it's important to point that comes out of this very lineage that we're talking about.
Yes, it comes out, but it also reinforces it.
Well, that's what Gary
suggests. It reinforces it, and I guess what the question is, how, you know, what is actually happening when a machine starts to think? What are we actually talking about? You know, if we don't want to fall into the imagery of we can just deliver, you know, modes of consciousness or awareness or affective relation, whatever, to machines, and so that we can be taken care of, Her, the movie Her, or, you know, Ex Machina, whatever, all this kind of popular...
Or Kurzweil himself.
Kurzweil, yeah, in terms of the singularity is coming. What is at stake there? I guess one task is the coalition cannot happen without engaging with the transformation of a tool into some kind of intelligent system.
As a part of the coalition.
As part of the coalition. I mean, there is no point that you aren't, you know, there is not an equal fight. It's like really talking about, you know, Israel and Palestine. It's not an equal fight. You're not on the same level.
Of
organization. It's about really creating some kind of we that, you know, of course needs to take into account the non-human, you know, the non-human, which I don't just mean some kind of non-human agent that coalesces with the human agent. There is a question of the human as a category is also an horizon that has to be constantly rewritten. You know, we had, you know, in this, you know, the discussion between Lyotard and Hannah Arendt, you know, during that period of thinking what is going to be, you know, what is outer space, you know, what this kind of extraterrestrial intelligence, what is the horizon of the human, is only there to rewrite it, to rewrite the project. So the project of the we cannot just be some kind of self-erasure we, but must be constructed. You got to construct the we in terms of this kind of possibility of crossing logic, revising logic, dismantling logic, there must be many methods, by which I don't mean a plurality that gets annexed together. It means, you know, there's obviously got to be a conflict and a struggle, because there is. We can't pretend that there is some kind of coalition that can happen just through human language or human history.
I mean, Gary, weren't you, we talked briefly about the limits of the category.
The
limits of the category human. And the there's a wonderful desire to sort of constantly expand it, right? People who, and this leads, and this is back to the Anthropocene, this leads to a need on the part of lots of environmental activists to attribute personhood or anthropomorphize nature and animals and trees and lakes and et cetera as a strategy, right? But the question you're, I'm asking you then, is there a limit to that strategy? I mean, do we just constantly?
Oh yes.
Do we just allow everything to be human?
It seems to me that this here too is a question of fragmenting multiplicities.
Exactly. That's
it, it is a question of multiple. As I was saying in the last session, it is a question of the exceptionalism of all species, right? The problem with the anthropocentrist and anthropomorphic view of species within the conservation community is a huge one these days. This is not to say that we don't want large mammals to survive into the next century. Of course we do. But the disproportionate share of funds that are going to those efforts, it has been noticed by people in the conservation community that we need to save coral reefs. You know, that is at least as essential as saving lions and rhinoceroses, and it's not happening because nobody's interested, because the personal the giving personhood
it's harder to
is,
do
it's hard to do to a coral reef, right? But if instead we were to take on board the extraordinary, complex, evolved exceptionalism of all of these species, right? And put ourselves in the midst of it in some way that reduces us rather than setting a gravitational well that pulls all species towards us with varying degrees of success. If we were to go there, something different might emerge even just in the conservation community. But even that, of course, is not getting to the kind of huge coalitional effort that is going to be necessary to do anything about the Anthropocene, which was already raised here, right? Yeah. Looked at in the big picture, the climate change deniers, or the man-made climate change deniers in the United States, who
and
are everywhere,
funding.
As you all know, they are quick to point out that across the whole Pleistocene era, 3 million years, the climate has been hugely variable. And paleoclimatologists over the last 100,000 years can map this out down to down to a decade level. This is hugely precise the way they have done this. Yes, it's hugely variable. Yes, it's a miracle that Homo sapiens or almost any other species managed to get through these quickly shifting environments. But what has happened now, what was happening then was, think of that niche construction that I was talking about in the last session. There you have the feedback between, say, late hominins, us and Neanderthals and a couple of other species, and their environments, shifting environments, quickly shifting environments. You've got a feedback mechanism. The climate is not a part of that feedback mechanism. The climate is a feed-forward control that affects that feedback mechanism, mm-hmm. right? It stands outside the mechanism as feed-forward and as a control mechanism. Mm-hmm. What has happened only in a very recent, very, very recent period is that we humans have dragged the climate into our feedback cycle of niche construction. Mm-hmm. It is now us, now that what used to be a control mechanism that controlled us is now, in a sense, controlled by us, with consequences that we have very little clue about, devastating consequences that are already being seen.
Sure.
You know, so it's interesting that the moment at which geologists are now, geologists are debating as to whether to take on Anthropocene as a new era, mm-hmm. But most of them seem to be settling on it. And then the question is, when do they date it? Because they have to have precise datings of these things. The one that seems to be being settled on is when the first substrates in the Earth of nuclear testing are detectable is the beginning of the Anthropocene, which puts it exactly at the moment of cybernetics, mm-hmm. exactly at the moment of the collapse of global colonies, exactly at the moment of the new discourses against racism and patriarchy. It's all happening in the middle of the 20th century at the same time.
Which is why there are those who also describe this era as the era of identity.
Yeah.
Right out of that period.
But wasn't already happening before? Is that just a consequence?
Of course it was. No, the geologists, of course it was happening before. But geologists are looking for a marker that can point to the upswing, the huge upswing in the force of this man-made climate change. There are other people who want to date it back to the Industrial Revolution. There's another view that takes it back to the early 17th century. And there are various points along the way. But the one they seem to be settling upon, interestingly enough, is maybe that's just our local perspective that is not able to kind of see the broader picture. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what I'm familiar with is those who try to date it around industrialization.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I guess I'm thinking also about the dangers of anthropomorphizing the Anthropocene.
Yeah, I'm very concerned with that. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking about a wonderful question I got last night that I couldn't answer, but it's haunted me all night, which is, is it possible that we can't care for things we don't anthropomorphize? Or because we know that one of the ways to generate a lack of concern for the other is by defining the other as less than human, right? Is there a reason why we can't mobilize a global coalition or politics around climate change? Does it have anything to do with our difficulty in seeing climate as a being or as a anthropomorphic being? Mm-hmm. But of course, that's also a problem.
Yeah. Well, that's a problem to the extent that there is a cognitive problem, you know, to the extent if we don't challenge, you know, the capacity of assuming an ontology based on a specific particular epistemology, which is still the epistemology of evolutionary science. You know, geology, there's been a lot of discussion lately about geology. The geopolitical is rooted within the geological discovery of parts of the earth, and the settlements come after. So if we don't, you know, kind of really make an effort to rewrite, or to rethink, or to expand, one could argue, but without just some kind of model of territorial expansion, what cognition can be, and without the model of the brain, I think we're really not going much farther, because you know, it's not just about being. So if we're saying that the anthropomorphization of things allows us to create some kind of political coalition,
I think
it's a very defeating point for us. You know, it's a defeating point because it means that we can only work politically within a very particular mode of being, which is instead historically, epistemologically, metaphysically produced. And doesn't allow to open any kind of horizon to ask, what if there is another mode of thinking, you know, to create some kind of inference from what is not known, rather than always already repeating, you know, the epistemological safe ground of what we know. So, one, I would have hoped that politics, not in the anthropomorphization of the Anthropocene, which are actually the same thing. I can't even distinguish them conceptually. Would actually allow for a mode of politics, you know, that is able to abstract from this particularity some images that are not already given in the history of a specific history of the human, because, you know, that,
Let me take a risk here and ask you a question.
Okay.
I'm wondering, I think about colleagues and friends, artists and scientists who are looking at non-human-centered thinking, trying to imagine the world and imagine political solutions, cross-cultural interactions, but not from the perspective of individuals and humans because of the hierarchies and the biases and the histories of the we and the problematic concerns there. Are you actually, I'm wondering this, in terms of the whole cybernetic project, are you suggesting that maybe we can upgrade our understanding of the unknown in non-human ways by sort of subjecting, no, the word subjecting is wrong, but by opening our ability to deal with new concepts outside of ourselves?
Outside of the
of ourselves. In technological ways, right. Specifically. Mm-hmm. Is that ultimately, I don't want to call you a transhumanist. I wouldn't do that.
You don't want to offend me.
But I'm just wondering, is that legitimate?
No, it can be legitimate from if I don't explain, I guess. The expansion of the horizon technology, through technology, the expansion of cognition to the horizon of technology is a very specific project that is based on a biocentric understanding of cognition, or neurocognition.
In the first place. Gotcha.
So I'm definitely not interested in that. What I'm interested in instead is how technology, in terms of I will talk about it a bit more later in the panel, is, you know, it's not just a doing, but also it's got a logic of allow for a capacity of reflectivity in what is in its capacity of gathering information and retrieving and elaborating. Because, you know, we need to think about this system not just as a kind of tool. That's why there are many things at play. So the kind of recursivity of understanding is not really just it doesn't really conform to the premises of neurobiological cognition.
Sure.
Right? It's got, for me, one has to critically claim of an alienness within it. That's why I think Jenna's work is fantastic, because she's trying to envision some kind of a language, a level of meaning that doesn't conform to what we already know a meaning is, but asks us, what is meaning? Mm-hmm. And it's not just semiotic, or, you know, we have all this method, the constructivism, post-structuralism, materialism, you know, but we it's a constant question, what is meaning? What kind of, because cognition has to do with meaning production, meaning production of meaning. So I guess we are at a juncture where all these things need to be rearticulated in view of a massive relativization of cognition, relativization of agency, relativization of meaning. So I agree about the exceptionalism that you were talking about, that there's always an exceptionalism. But the question is to understand what kind of image, what kind of geometric or not geometric structure or diagram can we have to allow for these asymmetries to talk to each other, because they are asymmetric rather than some kind of pan-humanism or pan-psychism.
Another word that we would have to reimagine would be then perhaps the coalitional, because the coalitional was better than the progressive, the utopian, the collective, the communitarian. The coalitional for me was at least the attempt to bring into multiple forms of conversation, multiple types of subjectivity, multiple types of creolization into some sort of specific understanding of a particular set of problems that sadly are rooted in human prejudice. We don't want to die. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we harness that, right? Mm-hmm. How do we harness that?
Finished? Wrap up.
Are we done? Are we done?
We don't want to stop with me asking. We don't want to die.
that was a great last word. Good.
Okay.
Thank you all.